A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The musical is the only narrative art form where a character can be mid-argument with their spouse, and instead of escalating to a shouting match, they harmonize. And we accept this. More than accept it. We pay $200 for the privilege. That's structurally bizarre, but it works. Think about it. In real life, if you're fighting with your partner about who forgot to pay the electric bill and suddenly you both start singing in thirds, something has gone deeply wrong. But in a musical, it's not just normal. It's often the most honest moment in the entire show. The harmony tells you something the argument couldn't. So Daniel sent us this one. He's asking two questions that sound simple but unravel fast. When was the first true musical performed? And outside the Broadway West End axis, is there a long tail of lesser-known musicals with devoted followings? There's a lot to unpack here.
Before we can answer when the first musical was, we need to agree on what a musical actually is, and that's trickier than it sounds, because the term gets thrown at everything from opera to a concert with a loose theme. So let's define it. A musical is a theatrical form with a narrative arc where characters sing at fixed intervals, and the music functions as a co-equal storytelling engine, not decoration, not intermission entertainment. The songs advance character, plot, or theme. If a song is cut, the show doesn't just lose a nice tune, it loses narrative coherence.
And that definition immediately excludes a bunch of things people confuse with musicals. Opera is through-sung. The entire text is set to music, and the vocal tradition is completely different. You're dealing with trained vibrato, no microphones, a completely different relationship between singer and audience. Operetta has spoken dialogue, but the music still dominates the storytelling in a way that makes the book secondary. Vaudeville and revue have no narrative through line at all. It's a parade of acts, so the musical sits in this weird middle ground where the book and the score are supposed to be equals, and that balance is what makes the origin question so sticky.
Because depending on what you prioritize, integration, spectacle, commercial intent, the presence of a coherent book, different shows become the first, and the historiography is genuinely contested. Not in a nobody-can-agree hand-wavy way, but in a this-reveals-what-we-actually-value-about-the-form way. If you think the essence of musicals is spectacle and box office, you pick one candidate. If you think it's narrative integration, you pick another. If you think it's popular accessibility, using tunes people already know, you pick a third. The origin story is a mirror.
How does that work in practice? Like, if I'm a theater historian sitting down to write the textbook, what's actually at stake in choosing one origin over another?
What's at stake is the entire intellectual lineage of the form. If you start with The Black Crook, you're telling a story about the musical as commercial entertainment, big, splashy, a little crass, fundamentally American. If you start with The Beggar's Opera, you're telling a story about the musical as satire, a form that steals from popular culture and uses it to critique power. If you start with Showboat, you're telling a story about the musical as serious drama, a form capable of tackling race and mortality. Each origin legitimizes a different version of what the musical should be. It's not just academic trivia. It shapes what gets funded, what gets reviewed seriously, what gets taught in conservatories.
Let's go back to 1866 to a theater in New York, and the show that most people point to as the beginning, Niblo's Garden, on Broadway near Prince Street. The show was The Black Crook, a 5.5-hour extravaganza that ran for 4.74 performances, which was absolutely unprecedented at the time. It cost $50,000 to produce, roughly $1 million in today's money. And the origin story is almost too good to be true. A Parisian ballet troupe was stranded in New York after their venue burned down, and a producer named William Wheatley basically grafted them onto a melodrama he was already staging. A Faustian tale about a crook-backed villain, plus 100 dancing ballerinas in flesh-colored tights.
It was a sensation, People were scandalized and thrilled in equal measure. But here's the thing. Was it a musical? By our definition, not really. The songs were mostly interpolated numbers. They didn't advance the plot. They stopped the show, literally. The ballet sequences had nothing to do with the melodrama. It was a Frankenstein monster of spectacle. Most musical theater historians consider it a proto-musical at best. It demonstrated there was an audience for this kind of hybrid entertainment, and it established the commercial viability of the form. But calling it the first musical is like calling a Zeppelin the first airplane. Related, but not the thing itself.
Covering the covers.
And here's a fun detail that often gets left out of the official story. The reason the ballet troupe was in New York in the first place. They were from the Théâtre de l'Académie Royale de Musique in Paris, and they'd been booked at the Academy of Music on 14th Street. But the Academy burned down in May of 1866, and Wheatley, who was already producing a melodrama called The Black Crook at Niblo's Garden, saw an opportunity. He didn't integrate them into the story. He literally just added ballet numbers between the acts of his existing show. The audience would watch a scene of melodramatic dialogue. Then the curtain would come down, then it would go back up, and there'd be a completely unrelated ballet sequence with 100 dancers in costumes that, by Victorian standards, were basically underwear. And people went absolutely wild for it.
The first musical was essentially a melodrama with a ballet revue stapled to it. That's almost too perfect a metaphor for how the form developed. Just keep adding things until something coheres.
Now, the counterclaim that's much stronger if integration is your criterion is The Beggar's Opera, 1728. And this is a fascinating piece of work. It was a ballad opera, meaning it used existing popular tunes, 69 of them, with new lyrics. Spoken dialogue between the songs. A satirical book that took aim at corruption, the legal system, and Italian opera, which Gay considered pretentious. And it was a massive hit, ran for 62 consecutive performances, which in 1728 was enormous. The songs weren't just decorative. They commented on the action, revealed character, advanced the satirical argument. Peachum and Locket singing about betrayal while being betrayers, that's integration.
If The Beggar's Opera is the stronger candidate, why does The Black Crook keep getting the crown in popular histories? Partly because it's American. There's a nationalistic impulse in theater history. The American musical wants an American origin story. Partly because The Black Crook created the template for commercial spectacle that Broadway still follows. And partly because The Beggar's Opera didn't spawn an unbroken lineage. Ballad opera had its moment and faded. The musical as we know it evolved through operetta, through Gilbert and Sullivan, through the Princess Theatre musicals of the 19-teens, before arriving at the real turning point.
The real turning point is Showboat, 1927. Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein II. This is the one where everything changes. Before Showboat, musicals were mostly revues, with a thin plot or operettas where the music was the point and the story was an excuse. Showboat did something radical. The songs advanced character and plot rather than stopping the show. And the case study everyone points to is Old Man River. It's not a love song. It's not a dance number. It's a song about the Mississippi River sung by a black stevedore named Joe, and it becomes his entire psychological arc. The river is indifferent. It keeps rolling. And that indifference is the commentary on race, on labor, on time, on mortality. A character song that is also a philosophical thesis. That had never been done before in a Broadway musical.
Showboat was also the first Broadway musical to feature a racially integrated cast in a serious dramatic context. Not as comic relief, not in blackface, but as characters with interiority and dignity. The opening number alone, the Cotton Blossom theme, establishes an entire world in about 4 minutes. You know who these people are, what they want, and what the stakes are. That's not decoration. That's dramatic machinery.
Here's what's wild about Showboat that people don't talk about enough. The show opens in the 1880s and ends in the 1920s. It spans 40 years. Characters age, marriages fall apart, children grow up. That kind of temporal scope was unheard of in musical theater. Most shows took place over a weekend. Showboat said, no, we're doing a multi-generational epic, and we're going to use the music to mark the passage of time. The reprise of Old Man River at the end. Joe is older, the river hasn't changed, and the weight of everything that's happened in between lands on those same notes. That's using music as a structural device, not just an emotional one.
Which brings us to the term integration. What does it actually mean as a technical term? It means the book, the lyrics, the music, the choreography. They're all telling the same story simultaneously. They're not taking turns. A fully integrated musical is one where you can't remove any element without damaging the whole. And the apotheosis of this, the show that made integration the orthodoxy, is Oklahoma. 1943. Rodgers and Hammerstein again. Hammerstein's second act, so to speak, of the Showboat. Rewired the form. The Dream Ballet, choreographed by Agnes DeMille, wasn't a divertissement. It was Laurie's subconscious, her fear and desire, rendered in movement. And the songs, Tape People Will Say, We're in Love. It's a duet, but it's not a love song. It's an argument about not falling in love. Two people who are clearly falling for each other, singing about all the things they shouldn't do because people will talk. The subtext is the text. Every verse advances both the plot and the emotional reality of the characters. That's integration.
Wait, can we pause on the Dream Ballet for a second? Because this was revolutionary, and it's easy to take it for granted now. Dance in musicals was either chorus girls doing kicks or a specialty number, tap dancing that stopped the show. DeMille's choreography did something completely different. It told a psychological story. Laurie dreams about what marrying Curly would be like, and what marrying Judd would be like, and the dream turns into a nightmare. The dancing isn't decoration. It's the plot. It's the character's inner life made visible, and audiences in 1943 had literally never seen anything like it. Some of them were confused. Some of them were moved to tears. But everyone understood that something fundamental about the form had shifted.
This is where the structural mechanics get interesting. There's a device called the 11 o'clock number. The name comes from a time when Broadway shows started at 8:30, so the penultimate song slot would land around 11. It's typically the emotional climax, the moment where the protagonist has a realization, a breakdown, or a breakthrough. Rose's turn in Gypsy, being alive in company. Memory in Cats, whatever you think of Cats. The 11 o'clock number is where the musical cashes the emotional check it's been writing all evening. And it only works if the integration has been doing its job, if the songs have been building toward this moment, the musical equivalent of the third act twist.
This is the thing about the form that's easy to miss. A musical isn't a play with songs, it's a different medium entirely. The songs aren't interruptions, they're the moments where the emotional logic of the story becomes explicit. In a straight play, a character might say, I'm conflicted. In a musical, they sing it, and the melody tells you something the words alone can't. The harmonic structure carries emotional information. A minor key shift mid-verse can convey doubt more efficiently than a page of dialogue.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure I follow that one.
Neither do I. Let's keep moving. So the origin story is messier than the textbooks suggest. But here's the thing. The present is even messier. Because for every Hamilton or Wicked, there are 1,000 musicals you've never heard of, and some of them are better. The prompt asks about the long tail, and this is where the conversation gets interesting. Broadway and the West End represent maybe 40 to 50 new productions per year combined. That's the visible tip of the iceberg. Beneath it, over 1,200 professional non-profit theaters in the United States alone, the Edinburgh Fringe with 3,500 plus shows, community productions estimated at over 100,000 annually worldwide. The musical isn't a dying art form. It's a distributed ecosystem that most people only see 1% of.
The numbers bear this out. The Edinburgh Festival Fringe in 2025 featured 3,548 shows, an estimated 15 to 20% of which were musicals or musical adjacent. That's 500 to 700 musical productions in a single festival. Most of them will never transfer. Most of them will never get a cast recording. But they exist, and people find them, and some of them develop fiercely devoted followings.
The cult musical phenomenon. Shows that never hit Broadway, or hit it briefly and died, but refused to die. The case study I keep coming back to is The Last 5 Years, Jason Robert Brown, 2001. Premiered off-Broadway at the Minetta Lane Theatre. Ran 57 performances. By commercial standards, a flop. But it has since received over 5,000 productions worldwide, Music Theatre International's licensing data confirms this. It's one of the most produced musicals in regional and educational theatre. Two-person cast, non-linear structure. One character tells the story forward, the other backward. They meet once in the middle, and it's devastating. No set changes, no chorus, no spectacle. Just a piano and two people singing about a marriage falling apart.
The non-linear structure is the key to why it works. Kathy sings the end of the relationship at the beginning of the show. Jamie sings the beginning at the beginning. So the audience is always ahead of both characters. You know what they don't know, and that dramatic irony is the engine. It's a structural innovation that mainstream musicals couldn't risk, but off-Broadway could, and that's the pattern. The long tail is where the form evolves. Broadway is where the successful mutations get commercialized.
Can we talk about what that actually feels like to watch? Because I've seen the last 5 years 3 times, and the experience is uniquely brutal. The first time, you're just trying to follow the structure. Okay, she's going backward, he's going forward. The second time, you know the structure, so you start noticing the echoes. A melody Kathy sings in her first song shows up in Jamie's last song, but you didn't catch it the first time because you were too busy orienting yourself. The third time, you realize the show is designed to be rewatched. The non-linear structure isn't a gimmick. It's a machine for generating new meaning on every encounter, and that's something a Broadway spectacle with $100 million budget can't necessarily do. Intimacy and structural complexity are a different kind of ambition.
The workshop culture is the invisible infrastructure here. Hamilton didn't appear fully formed at the Richard Rogers Theater. It had a 2013 workshop at Vassar, then a 2014 off-Broadway run at the Public Theater. Then it transferred. Shows can spend 5 to 10 years in development with multiple regional productions before any commercial run. Hadestown, 14 years from concept album to Broadway. Anais Mitchell wrote it as a community theater project in Vermont. The long tail isn't downstream of Broadway. Broadway is downstream of the long tail.
Then there's the experimental fringe. Dave Malloy, 2014. A 4-person song cycle about whiskey, telescopes, and reincarnation ran in a 99-seat theater at the Bushwick Star. No linear plot. No characters in the traditional sense. 4 performers who trade roles and instruments. The music genre hops from folk to jazz to electronic to something I can only describe as haunted sea shanty. And it built a devoted following entirely through word of mouth and a cast recording. People get ghost quartet tattoos. They host listening parties. They learn the harmonies and sing them in stairwells. That's not a Broadway audience. That's something else entirely. The musical equivalent of a cult film. The Rocky Horror of folk opera.
Rocky Horror itself is a fascinating parallel, because that's a show that bombed on Broadway. 45 performances in 1975 and became a cultural institution through midnight screenings and audience participation. The long tail can outlast the commercial failure. The devoted following becomes the distribution mechanism.
Here's a fun fact about Rocky Horror that ties into what we were saying about integration. The audience participation, the callbacks, the props, the toast, the newspapers, none of that was planned. It emerged organically. Fans started shouting responses at the screen, and over time, those responses became canonized. It's a completely decentralized, crowdsourced layer of the show that the original creators had nothing to do with. And no, you can't see Rocky Horror without it. The audience is part of the score. That's a kind of integration that no composer could have written. And it only happened because the show failed commercially and found a second life in a different medium.
Which brings us to the digital long tail. YouTube and TikTok as discovery engines for musical theater. The most extreme example is Ratatouille the Musical, 2020-2021. It started as a TikTok trend, people writing songs for a hypothetical musical adaptation of the Pixar film. Over 100 million views in December 2020. It coalesced into an actual virtual concert with Broadway performers. Wayne Brady, Titus Burgess, Adam Lambert raised $2 million for the Actors Fund. And it happened entirely outside the traditional development pipeline. No regional tryout. Just a platform, a community, and a shared joke that became sincere.
The sincerity is the interesting part. It started as a meme and became art, because people actually cared about making it good. The songs weren't parody. They were genuine attempts at musical theater songwriting, constrained by the medium, 60-second vertical videos, and somehow that constraint produced creativity rather than stifling it.
This connects to something bigger about the form. The musical has always been a hybrid, borrowing from whatever popular music was current. The Black Crook borrowed from ballet and melodrama. The Beggar's Opera borrowed from popular ballads. Showboat borrowed from spirituals and jazz. Hair borrowed from rock. Hamilton borrowed from hip-hop. Ratatouille borrowed from TikTok's native grammar. Duets, stitches, short-form hooks. The form is parasitic in the best sense. It absorbs and transforms.
Let's talk economics, because the long tail exists partly because the commercial model is so punishing. Approximately 80% of Broadway musicals fail to recoup their initial investment. That's Broadway League data. The average musical costs 10 to 20 million to mount, and the weekly running costs can hit 600,000 for a large show, so most shows lose money. The ones that succeed, Hamilton, Wicked, The Lion King, succeed so spectacularly that they subsidize the ecosystem. But the risk aversion this creates is real. More jukebox musicals, more film adaptations, more revivals of proven properties. The economics push towards safety.
The long tail doesn't have the same economic constraints. A regional theater production might cost $50,000. A fringe festival show might cost $5,000. A TikTok musical costs nothing but time. The failure is cheaper, so the experimentation is freer. And this is why the most innovative musicals of the next decade are probably being workshopped in a 200-seat theater in Chicago or a fringe venue in London right now, not in a Broadway development lab.
The devoted follower ecosystem is part of this. Theater Twitter, Musical Theater Appreciation Month, fan conventions like BroadwayCon. And the phenomenon that's most revealing, slime tutorials. If you don't know what that is, it's a euphemism. Bootleg recordings of live performances, shared among fans under fake labels to avoid copyright strikes. They're called slime tutorials because that's what the uploaders titled them. Slime Tutorial Part 1. It's a whole shadow library. And it exists because of scarcity. Many shows never get cast recordings, limited runs in specific cities. If you don't live in New York or London, you might never see a particular musical. So fans create an alternative distribution network.
Before anyone clutches pearls about piracy, the economics here are complicated. The people who watch slime tutorials are often the same people who buy tickets when a show tours, who buy cast recordings, who evangelize to friends. It's not substitution, it's the funnel. The scarcity of the form, limited runs, geographic constraints, creates a hunger that the commercial model can't satisfy, so the community fills the gap.
There's a parallel with the Grateful Dead's taper section. The band realized that letting fans record and trade tapes built a community that bought tickets for decades. The musical theater industry hasn't quite figured this out yet, but the fans have.
Some shows are almost entirely sustained by this kind of devotion. The Fantastics, the longest-running musical in history, off-Broadway, 42 years at the Sullivan Street Playhouse, 17,162 performances. It's never been a Broadway hit. It's an intimate two-act fable with a piano and a harp, but has been performed in over 67 countries and translated into dozens of languages. The long tail isn't a niche curiosity. It's the majority of the form's life.
What do we do with this knowledge? How do we actually find the good stuff in the long tail? Three concrete recommendations. 1. Search for off-Broadway cast recordings on streaming services. Spotify and Apple Music have deep catalogs. Ghost Quartet, The Last 5 Years, The Secret Garden, Floyd Collins, A New Brain. Shows that never had a Broadway run but have cast albums that are masterpieces in their own right. 2. Look up the New York Musical Festival archives. NYMF ran from 2004 to 2019 and premiered over 400 new musicals. Many of the shows that later transferred, Next to Normal, for example, started there. The archives are a treasure map. 3. Follow regional theater critics. The Chicago Tribune's Chris Jones, the LA Times' Ashley Lee. They cover shows that never transfer, and their reviews are often the only record those productions ever get.
The thing to understand is that these recommendations aren't consolation prizes. Oh, you can't get to Broadway, here's the minor leagues. The long tail is where the form does its most interesting work because the stakes are lower and the constraints are different. a show like Dave Malloy's Octet, an a cappella chamber musical about internet addiction, premiered at the Signature Theater off-Broadway, could never work in a 1,000-seat Broadway house. The intimacy is the point. The close harmonies, the unamplified voices, the 99 seats. That's not a limitation. That's the medium.
The musical is uniquely suited to this moment in a way that isn't obvious. We're in an era of fragmented attention, short-form content, algorithmic discovery. And the musical's built-in variety, song, dance, dialogue, spectacle, maps surprisingly well to that. A musical is already a playlist with a plot. It's already a series of emotional peaks separated by narrative valleys. The form was designed for variety before variety was a media consumption pattern.
Music bypasses intellectual defenses in a way that dialogue doesn't. You can argue with a character's logic. You can't argue with a minor key. A well-placed chord change can make you feel something before you understand why. That emotional directness is the form's superpower, and it's why musicals survive every prediction of their demise. The form has been declared dead approximately every 15 years since The Black Crook. And yet here we are, with a TikTok-born musical raising $2 million for charity.
The origin question is unanswerable in a definitive sense. The Black Crook gave us spectacle and commercial viability. The Beggar's Opera gave us integration and satire. Showboat gave us psychological realism. Gave us the integrated musical as orthodoxy. And every one of those firsts is really a claim about what we value. The debate reveals the form's hybrid DNA. Part opera, part vaudeville, part straight play, part spectacle. The musical is a mongrel form, and that's its strength. It can absorb anything.
The long tail is not a footnote to that story. It's where the absorption happens. The most innovative musicals of the next decade are probably being sung in a 99-seat theater or a TikTok duet right now, not in a Broadway development lab with a $20 million budget. The form evolves at the edges, not the center.
One open question before we wrap. There have been experiments with AI-generated musicals. Beyond the Fence in 2016 was the first computer-generated musical, produced in London's West End. The songs were composed by machine learning models trained on a database of musical theater hits. The reviews were, but the question it raises is genuine. Can an AI ever produce a musical that feels emotionally integrated, that makes an audience feel something real? Or is the human element, the fact that someone wrote these words and these notes because they had something to say, non-negotiable?
I'm skeptical, but I'll admit my skepticism might be sentimental. A musical works because we sense intention behind it. A composer made a choice to modulate here, to repeat this motif, to undercut this lyric with that harmony. If an AI makes those choices probabilistically, does the emotional logic still hold? But I think there's something about the embodied human experience, the fact that a songwriter has had their heart broken and knows what that feels like in their body. That might be the irreducible core of the form. The musical is the only art form where we accept that characters will suddenly sing their innermost thoughts. That suspension of disbelief requires trust, and trust might require a human on the other end.
The musical equivalent of Made with Love on a Jar of Jam. It might not change the chemical composition, but it changes the experience of eating it. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend. We'll be back next week with another prompt.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
The term Grand Duke as a royal title traces back to the late 6th century, but its modern usage was formalized by Tsar Ivan the Terrible in 1547 when he created the title Grand Duke of Muscovy, though the etymological root actually comes from the Latin Dux Grandis, meaning large leader, which somehow survived 15 centuries of European succession crises to become the title for the guy who runs Luxembourg.
Oh, right.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.